So we thought we would start by chatting a little bit and then letting our readings sort of emerge out of our conversation. We haven't talked too much. I love talking with Kevin, I think. We haven't talked a great deal about the program other than the basics, so we're going to sort of fly without a net, and I think that's the best way to do it, see what sort of comes up. So, first of all, thank you to CJ Pip and all the co-sponsoring organizations, and thank you all for coming. It's an honor to be with Kevin and with all of you. So, I guess the first thing I would say is that when we talk about Jewish dissident tradition, it almost seems redundant to me, because I think to be a Jew is to be a dissident in many different ways, and I think dissent is something that is just so thoroughly woven into the fabric of Jewish life and the Jewish religion. The Talmud, which is the basic foundation of Jewish law, Jewish tradition as we know it, is basically a record of dissents. It is a conversation of people dissenting with one another. And on occasion, voices trying to marginalize one another. So all of this business is nothing new in Jewish life. But debate and dissent, I think, is really the lifeblood of what Judaism is all about. And the efforts within the organized Jewish community throughout history to marginalize those who dissent from what is considered to be, you know, air quotes, considered to be normative, is also something that we've seen from time immemorial. We can trace it back to, you know, Korach in the Bible, who was dissenting with Moses' leadership. And we can look at people like Spinoza in the Middle Ages, and Mordechai Kaplan, who was the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, my denomination, was thoroughly excoriated by the Jewish community of his time. His Haggadah, the first work that he produced to be used in a ritual fashion, was the Reconstructionist Haggadah, which was publicly burned in New York City. So this kind of thing is nothing new. Although I would say that, as we all know, Israel-Palestine has become the flashpoint for, I think, ground zero for dissent in American Jewish life, certainly, but not only, I think, around the world as well. When we look at the rise of the Zionist movement, this conversation was a very lively conversation. I'm going to offer a few readings about that reflect that conversation. But I guess that's the first thing I want to say, is that I'm very proud of the Jewish tradition of dissent. I think not only dissenting within the ranks, but seeing yourself as a dissident in the human condition, to look at the status quo and to challenge it, to speak truth to power, to call out power when it's used oppressively. That is, I think, again, going back to the prophets, going back to some of our biblical forerunners, is a time-honored Jewish tradition. So when we talk about the Jewish dissident tradition, I think we're really talking about Jewish tradition. That's the first thing I would point out.
Nice. Yeah, and so for me, you know, I grew up in the suburb. I grew up in Northbrook, and I didn't really know that Jewish dissident tradition. I just knew the Jewish assimilationist tradition in this country, and I thought that was corny and whack and boring. And so for me, for such a long time, growing up as a kid, I didn't really want anything to do with my Jewishness. You know, Hebrew school was dull and was radically disconnected from my life. And at 16, I told my best friend not to call me Jewish anymore because I wanted to be a Black Panther. Because the music that I was listening to, hip-hop, that I've been listening to pretty much every day since 1984, was giving me a different narrative about American history. And that had resonance with me, in part because I saw my mom work very much and very often, and that was a different experience that I was seeing my friends' families live in you know, the assimilated upper middle class suburb of Northbrook. And so I guess in some ways that's a part of the Jewish tradition, is to also feel like you're not really Jewish. It was later when I was in India and I was with one of my best friends, Ibu Patel, who's Muslim, but both he and I were in India trying to learn about the world's religions in a real concerted effort. We spent that summer, about 4 months in India, in about 9 or 10 different religious communities. And it was when we were with the Dalai Lama that Ibu and I went in. We had like a private audience, just me and the Dalai Lama. Like a few days before, we played basketball with the Dalai Lama's bodyguards. They're not very peaceful on the basketball court. We were with the we were like, oh, we're gonna really impress, you know, the Dalai Lama with all we know about various sutras. You know what I mean? We were gonna come in and be like, look, Dalai Lama, I know you got this, but let me tell you what I know about the Diamond Sutra. And at some point, he just busted out laughing, and he like stuck his finger kind of hard, like in the middle of my chest, and he's like, "Be a good Jew." And he did the same thing to Ibu. He's like, "Yo, be a good." He didn't say yo, but he was like, said he did the same thing to Ibu. He said, "Be a good Muslim," and that was revelatory for us because we didn't know that that's what we were meant to do. So I went back that summer. This is, I think, the summer of 98 or 99. And both Ibu and I kind of re-upped and invested ourselves in learning things that were left out of our formal and informal religious and cultural education. And it was then when I really discovered, rediscovered, and explored for myself the tradition of both Jewish descent in its religious and cultural roots, that Abraham himself was a dissenter, disagreed radically with his father, and bust all the idols in his pop's corner store, because he believed in a unifying principle that united all things. You know, that's radical at the time. I'm sure Abraham's pops was pissed that he broke all the idols in his store. And so for me, you know, it... I think the first Jewish texts upon reflection are not, because one of the things that you know, Brant and I talked about was, you know, sharing texts that inspired us. And for me, the first texts that inspired me were not Jewish necessarily. Well, they were Jewish, but they weren't Jewish. By Jews.
Jewish, but not Jewish.
Yeah. Thank you. Right. And so for me, you know, like my, I continue to come back always to hip hop and to literature written by black folks. Toni Morrison in a beautiful essay about the literary imagination, it's called Playing in the Darkness. She talks about if you really want to know about white folks, you have to read black literature. And I think that there's a large truth in that. So I don't know. I don't know if you want to start. I'm gonna read this piece that was real informational and important in my own development. It steered me ultimately away from and then back to Judaism. This was a rhyme I memorized in the late '80s, and it's from my favorite teacher, poet, and rapper of all time, KRS-One, from a crew called Boogie Down Productions. And I memorized this at Doug Collins basketball camp, which was not far from here, Concordia College. And I went back in the fall to share this rhyme with my rabbi, who was not impressed. It goes, Genesis chapter 14, verse 13. Abraham steps on the scene. Being a descendant of Shem, which is a fact, means Abraham too was black. Abraham born in the city of a black man called Nimrod, grandson of Ham. Ham had 4 sons. One was named Canaan. Let me do some explaining. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons for real, and these were the children of Israel. According to Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, Egyptians descended from Ham. 600 years later, my brother, read up. Moses was born in Egypt, and these Arab black Egyptians weren't right. They enslaved black Israelites. Moses had to be of the black race because he spent 40 years in Pharaoh's place. He passed as the Pharaoh's grandson. So we had to look just like them. Yes, my brothers and sisters, stay strong. Go correct the wrong, because the information we get to date is just whack. So ask yourself, why is that? Karis won, you know? And Word. But, you know, I was like 14, 13 when I memorized that, took it back to my rabbi. He was like, you need to get out the synagogue. And and so, but that notion of, you know, but the information we get today is just whack. Ask yourself, why is that, has been a ringing principle throughout my whole time, you know?
So, yeah, let's start with some of the works that inspire us, or continue with that. We have plenty of stuff, we brought plenty of stuff that we've written, but I think it makes sense, actually, to start with some of the foundational stuff for us. For me, I always go back to the prophets. They were the truth tellers of their time, and if you read the prophets, they were tortured souls. You know, they were caught between a rock and a hard place. They were constantly trying to speak truth to power. Often some of the prophets were in with power, you know, like Nathan, for instance. Natan was King David's prophet. You know, Samuel was a prophet that was caught between kings and the people as well, and God. So they're definitely tortured people, but there's a constant sense of, out of that angst, out of that pain, this ferocity that's uncompromising in cutting to the core of what we need to do and what is important, and all the rest being just commentary or worse. And so I brought, for me, my favorite, the one I always go back to, it comes from Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58 is part of the later Isaiah chapters. I won't go into biblical scholarship, but a lot of the classic Isaiah comes from this section of the Bible. This is actually one that Jews read ceremonially. This is part of the Haftarah, the prophetic portion that's read on Yom Kippur. So this is a central prophetic reading. Jews actually, we don't, traditional Judaism doesn't quote prophets so much, interestingly enough. When I meet my Protestant brothers and sisters, they know much more about prophets than I do. The Protestant church in particular spends a lot of time on prophets, both liturgically and study-wise. But the prophets in traditional Judaism have gotten sort of short shrift for all kinds of complex and unfortunate reasons. I think the early reform movement really revived the prophets. For me, whenever I go back to the prophets, it just reminds me why I do this. And it reminds me what is truly important. So this is an excerpt from the prophetic reading that we do in Yom Kippur. It begins with Isaiah 58, verse 2. To be sure they seek me daily, eager to learn my ways. This is actually Isaiah speaking, but these are Isaiah speaking God's words, basically. To be sure they seek me daily, eager to learn my ways, like a nation that does what is right, that has not abandoned the Lord, the laws of its God. They ask me for the right way. They are eager for the nearness of God. Why, when we fasted, did you not see? When we starved our bodies, did you pay no heed? Because on your fast day, you see to your business and oppress all your laborers. Because you fast in strife and contention, and you strike with a wicked fist. Your fasting today is not such as to make your voice heard on high. Is this the fast I desire? A day for men to starve their bodies? Is it bowing the head like a bulrush and lying in sackcloth and ashes? Do you call that a fast? A day when the Lord is favorable? No, this is the fast I desire, to unlock fetters of wickedness and untie the cords of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break off every yoke. It is to share your bread with the hungry and to take the wretched poor into your home, and when you see the naked, to clothe him and not to ignore your own kin. Then shall your light burst through like the dawn and your healing spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall march before you. The presence of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. When you cry, he will say, here I am. If you banish the yoke from your midst, the menacing hand and evil speech, and you offer your compassion to the hungry and satisfy the famished creature, then shall your light shine in darkness, and your gloom shall be like noonday.
The Lord will guide you always. He will slake your thirst in parched places and give strength to your bones. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring whose waters do not fail.
You know, I would die a happy man if I just heard Kevin Colval read Isaiah 58.
Think you could give it a try?
Sure.
All right.
It's
from there to there.
All right. Cool. I thought you were doing a good job.
No. This is hip hop Isaiah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yo, no. Oi is the reverse. You know that joke.
The other side of the same.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Very good. Oi, no, I'm joking. All right. To be sure, they seek me daily, eager to learn my ways, like a nation that does what is right, that has not abandoned the laws of its God. They ask me for the right way. They are eager for the nearness of God. Why, when we fasted, did you not see? When we starved our bodies, did you pay no heed? Because on your fast day, you see to your business and oppress all your laborers. Because you fast in strife and contention, and you strike with the wicked fist. Your fasting today is not such as to make your voice heard on high. Is such the fast I desire, a day for men to starve their bodies? Is it bowing the head like a bulrush and lying in sackcloth and ashes? Do you call that a fast, a day when the Lord is favorable? No, this is the fast I desire, to unlock fetters of wickedness and untie the cords of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break off every yoke. It is to share your bread with the hungry and to take the wretched poor into your home. When you see the naked, to clothe him, and not to ignore your own kin. Then shall your light burst through the dawn, and your healing spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall march before you. The presence of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then, when you call, the Lord will answer. When you cry, he will say, "Here I am." If you banish the yoke from your midst, the menacing hand and evil speech, and you offer your compassion to the hungry and satisfy the famished creature, then shall your light shine in darkness and your gloom shall be like noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will slake your thirst in parched places and give strength to your bones. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring whose waters do not fail.
Woo! Back to our regularly scheduled Kevin Colval.
No. That was, yeah, he's got bars. You know, for me, I think, I promise I'm going to read some Jews in a minute, but it is American prophets who've really put me on the path towards understanding my Jewishness, and through the lens of the other, I've understood myself. I don't think that that's unique to the American experience, but I think it's certainly something that has aided me quite a bit. And so I'm going to read an American prophet, James Baldwin, in his essay. He says, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white. And so I read this early on as a way to understand my discontent with privilege, and also wanting to throw off that yoke in some ways, and seeing from early on so many things that I thought wrong and problematic with systems of racism that I didn't have a real explanation for it until I started to fully read some of the black poets and scholars that I got in high school, not because the Glenbrook North faculty was progressive, but because the Northbrook Public Library had a very small section called Black Studies. And KRS-One and Chuck D ultimately sent me there to read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And in that same section, I found the black poets like Amiri Baraka, Sonia Sanchez, Nikki Giovanni, Hakeem Adabudi, Jane Cortez, and ultimately James Baldwin as well. This is a very small section. He says, in the American context, the most ironical thing about Negro anti-Semitism is that the Negro is really condemning the Jew for having become an American white man, for having become, in effect, a Christian. And so for me, I definitely, no shots, did not want to be a Christian. So I had to go back and understand my Jewishness, my Judaism, from a religious level, really, because it didn't mean much when I memorized my Haftorah. So it was later, after the Dalai Lama, you know, stuck his finger in my chest, that I went back and read some of the prophets and also explored some Kabbalah. And so I'm going to read to you what resonated for me with some of the kind of like mystical synergy between what I thought is hip-hop cultural practice and Jewish religious practice. Because if I was going to be a Jew, I was going to have to, you know, do it with fresh hip-hop style, and also needed to continue the practice I was engaging in as an artist. And so in hip-hop, you know, there's the practice of freestyle, which was a way for me to kind of initially, when I came back to Chicago in 95, 96, find a community of writers and poets who were engaged in this art form of just improvisational rhyming. And it reminded me, when I read this passage from Abraham Abulafia, who's like a, you know, Spanish Jewish mystic, this practice that he's talking about. He says, then you take hold of ink, pen, and tablet. Realize that you are about to serve your God in joy. Begin to combine letters, a few or many, permuting and revolving them rapidly until your mind warms up. Delight in how they move and in what you generate by revolving them. When you feel within that your mind is very, very warm from combining the letters, and that through the combinations you understand new things that you have not attained by human tradition nor discovered on your own through mental reflection, then you are ready to receive the abundant flow. And the abundance flows upon you, arousing you again and again. And when I read that, I was like, dang, that's hip-hop. And Jew-ness. And I thought that that was fresh, you know, so that sent me back in.
So I'm going to talk a little about Israel-Palestine now. This is C.J. Pip, after all, so we have to find our way back or up toward the this particular issue. I want to read a few excerpts from figures who were affiliated with a movement called B'rit Shalom. I'm sure there are many people in the room who are familiar with B'rit Shalom. Around the rise of the Zionist movement, as immigration increased into Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century in particular, there was a great deal of friction between, increased friction and tension and occasionally violence between the Jewish settlers and the Palestinian population there. And the British mandate, the British who had mandate over the over that area, were constantly playing one side against the other. Although clearly, I think most historians point out that they, since the Balfour Declaration, were clearly throwing their cards with the Zionists first and foremost. At any rate, in the early 20th century, the Zionist movement still had many different factions, and there was one small but very important group called B'rit Shalom. It was founded in 1925 by people like Rabbi Judah Magnus, who was an American rabbi, one of my huge heroes, reform rabbi who moved to Palestine, the journalist Hannah Arendt, the philosopher Martin Buber, Hans Kohn, who I'm going to read from in a moment, Henrietta Zold. And these were people who considered themselves Zionists and part of the Zionist movement, but were advocating very, very strongly, very passionately for a binational state, and saying that creating a sovereign Jewish political entity in historic Palestine was going to be a recipe for eternal war. Whether it was through partition or whether it was through taking all of the land and forcing the native population out, they understood that the core reason for this tension was not simply Jews moving to Palestine, but Jews moving to Palestine with the express purpose of creating a political sovereign presence there. And so I'm going to read to you first from Hans Kohn. Anybody, any Hans Kohn fans out there? All right, Hans Kohn was a Jewish philosopher and a political scientist. Was born originally in Prague, but he moved to Palestine in 1925, but later broke from Brit Shalom and broke from the Zionist movement and moved to the United States. He moved to the United States in 1934. He taught and spent the rest of his life there. He died in 1971. He taught at Smith College. He taught at City College in New York. He wrote some of the, for his time, some of the most important works on nationalism. And he very consciously, after the riot, Arab riots of 1929, which was a huge traumatic event for the population in historic Palestine, he broke with the Zionist movement. He wrote a letter to Martin Buber, who was his teacher, really, and his mentor in Brit Shalom, and said, "I'm leaving the Zionist movement." Because there were two sort of takes on what the reality of what the significance of the Arab riots were. For many of the political Zionists of various partisan stripes, they said, they interpreted this as, see, these Arabs are savages, they don't want us here, there can be no peace between us, this is why we need political power. And there were others like Kohn and others in Brit Shalom who were saying, this is the inevitable outcome of political Zionism, that when you colonize a land, and do it against the will of its indigenous population, they're going to resist. And they saw this as people like Hans Kohn and others saw this as a very terrifying harbinger of what's to come. So when you read people like Hans Kohn and Hannah Arendt and Judah Magnus, their warnings they're just so poignant and so terrifying. They're so prescient. They're like, they predicted what we are living in today. They're saying this is a recipe for eternal war. And at one point, Hannah Arendt writes in an essay, maybe I'll get to it, says, you're going to create a Jewish Sparta that's going to become over-militarized, and all of the incredible culture that the cultural Zionists were talking about a rebirth of Jewish identity, is going to be lost, and it's going to be, this nation is going to be concentrated on stronger and stronger military in order to keep out these enemies. And so when you read it, it's chilling, it's terrifying, it's deeply saddening. I also find it very inspiring, because among all the Zionist thinkers that you might read, to me it's the thinkers of Brit Shalom that still speak to us today. So I want to read to you from Hans Kohn's letter to Martin Buber that he wrote in November 1929, right after the Arab riots, where he formally breaks with the Zionist movement. It's a classically Jewish dissident work. And these are excerpts from the letter. "Lately, I have become increasingly aware that the official policy of the Zionist organization and the opinion of the vast majority of Zionists are quite incompatible with my own convictions. I therefore feel that I can no longer remain a leading official within the Zionist organization. The Zionism championed by me since 1909 was in no time political. I and a group of my friends regarded Zionism as a moral, spiritual movement within which we could realize our most fundamental humane convictions, our pacifism, liberalism, and humanism. It has often been argued that we Jews could not unreservedly sponsor pacifism or ethical politics among the European peoples, since this would result in our being regarded as alien and traitors. Zion was to be the place where we would be able to realize our humanitarian aspirations. The reality of the Zionist movement and of Jewish settlements in Palestine is far from all this. You know that for years I have been fighting the battle for those ideas which to me have been the very meaning of Zionism. Eventually, these ideas gained focus in the so-called Arab question. It has, alas, become increasingly clear to me that in this respect, the Zionist organization has failed utterly. The overwhelming majority of Zionists feel justified in pursuing a course which I cannot follow. For the few who think like me, the need for an honest and clear decision has arrived. As a Jew and as a human being, as a Jewish human being, two qualities which in me are inseparable and parallel, I am a pacifist, an anti-imperialist, and what in America is called a radical. I am emphasizing these three points because they are called into question by official Zionist policy. I cannot concur with this policy when the Arab national movement is being portrayed as the wanton agitation of a few big landowners. I know all too well that frequently the most reactionary imperialist press in England and France portrays the national movements in India, Egypt, and China in a similar fashion. In short, whenever the national movements of oppressed people threaten the interests of colonial power, I know how false and hypocritical this portrayal is. I can even less be a party to this approach when such an when such is the attitude of a people which consciously regards itself as a chosen people, and when the future of a movement, the Zionist movement, which I can only envisage if it is built on ethical foundations, is at stake. The means determine the goal. If lies and violence are the means, the results cannot be good. We pretend to be innocent victims. Of course the Arabs attacked in August. Since they have no armies, they could not obey the rules of war. They perpetrated all the barbaric acts that are characteristic of a colonial revolt. But we are obliged to look deeper into the causes of this revolt. We have been in Palestine for 12 years, since the establishment of the British Mandate and Jewish National Home in Palestine, without having even once made a serious attempt at seeking through negotiations the consent of the indigenous people. We have been relying exclusively on Great Britain's military might. We have set ourselves goals which by their very nature had to lead to conflict with the Arabs. We ought to have recognized that these goals would be the cause, the just cause, of a national uprising against us. Having come to this country as immigrants, we were duty-bound to come up with constitutional proposals which, without doing serious harm to Arab rights and liberty, would have also allowed for our free cultural and social development. But for 12 years, we pretended that the Arabs did not exist and were glad when we were not reminded of their existence. The Arab riots, which were suppressed by the British, should have been met as quickly as possible by peace proposals instead of evasive maneuvers. That was our duty. But just like the powers in the First World War, we have declared that we would gladly make peace if only we were strong enough. That means we are seeking a victorious peace just as they were, a peace whereby the opponent does what we want. Naturally, each party wants peace on the condition that he can obtain what he considers essential, not, however, a higher forum and not a more lofty conscience. It was against this attitude taken by the powers in the First World War and against this point of view that the true pacifists rebelled. I would be glad if we also had a few such pacifists among our ranks. If only the Jews could show such courage in their own affairs as was demonstrated, for example, by the English pacifists in the World War. Each delay in the signing of a peace treaty renders peace more difficult by widening the gap between the two peoples. The Arab national movement is growing, and it will continue to grow. In a short time, it will be much more difficult for us to reach an agreement than it is today. Increasing our numbers by tens of thousands will not make it any easier. This letter is meant only for you. It requires no answer. It deals with questions which each individual must ultimately answer for himself. My resignation from the Zionist movement closes an era of my life. I have 20 years spent exclusively in Zionist activity, 10 of them in Keren HaYesod, is no small part of a human life. One is accountable both to himself and to his friends for such a period. I have written to you about the road which I have now placed behind me. I still know very little about the road ahead of me. The old beaten paths of national policy, as they were followed by the European peoples in the 19th century, the Eastern peoples in the 20th century, and now by the Jewish people, are for me no longer valid. We must search for a completely new and different path. Sometimes, I still retain a proud hope that the Jews, nationally conscious Jews, might forge these new paths. With most cordial wishes and greetings, faithfully yours, Hans Cohn.
That could have dropped yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's really powerful. Maybe in a minute we'll read our own work. You know, that the politic to be anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, is something that I think I've subsequently learned is also, it seems to be, a Jewish religious imperative, cultural imperative, certainly part of the work that we've tried to do in some extent in this country and other places. For me, it comes through those poets that I discovered in the library. Reading Amiri Baraka was my first introduction to the idea of third world liberation Marxism, which I didn't know what that meant then. I don't know if I still do exactly, but the notion that we must resist colonial forces is something that resonated with me when I was 15, and something that seems ever more present in the struggle to liberate peoples around the planet and in this city now. It was through those poets that I started to really write, and it was through my relationship with a Palestinian-American poet, Suher Hamad, where I was kind of immersed in a contemporary conversation around Palestine and the move to raise awareness and work in communities here and abroad to generate interest in the work at a mass level. Suher introduced me to other Palestinian poets like Mahmoud Darwish, and Darwish introduced me to a translator, Peter Cole, and his press, and they put out an Israeli poet a few years ago who I had not heard of, who's older, Aharon Shabti, who is, his book, J'accuse, I don't know French, so excuse my...
Pardon my French?
Yeah, pardon my French. But this is a poet who I love, who's Jewish and Israeli, and seems to be giving us a bit of a jump off for the next few days. This is a poem called Passover. Instead of scalding your pots and plates, take steel wool to your hearts. You read the Haggadah like swine, which, if put before a table, would forge about in the bowl for parsley and dumplings. Passover, however, is stronger than you are. Go outside and see. The slaves are rising up. A brave soul is burying its oppressor beneath the sand. Here is your cruel, stupid Pharaoh dispatching his troops with their chariots of war. And here is the sea of freedom, which swallows them. And you know, one of the things that I love about the Seder that we're about to get our gefilte fish on for is the notion in there where they say each generation reveals new freedoms. That, you know, certainly my parents' generation was battling against their parents. And I know that my generation and generations to come will continue to reveal new freedoms. And I know in my heart of hearts that this is that moment to reveal the necessity to decolonize and have justice in Palestine. I know that this is this moment. So I think you know, what's next is that we're going to read maybe from our own work a little bit, and then, you know, we'll see what happens from there. You know, I'll start with a poem that's not about Israel-Palestine, but is very much about the necessity in this country to assimilate into whiteness, into dominant culture. And I think that there's resonance for me in how we have become dominant and how that's affected our politic around the globe and certainly here at home. All the women in my family got nose jobs. My moms, my aunt, my grandma, a lot of the young women I went to high school with, and I understand that it has to do with misogyny and patriarchy and certainly a European standard of beauty. And so our movement to the center of the culture is an assimilation into whiteness, and it made us go through major surgery to alter how we look. And so one of the things I wanted to do in this book of poems, Shtick, which is a big book of poems, is celebrate things that make us particularly Jewy, because I like Jews for the most part, kind of, sometimes. But one of the things I definitely like about Jews that I find like irresistibly sexy and fresh is our big noses. And we share those, of course, with, you know, Semitic people around the globe and other people who are, you know, have big noses. No shots to people who don't have big noses, but I wanted to celebrate the big nose. There's a big section of the book about the nose job, but this is an ode to the schnoz. Oh, Gonzo, what length, what mucusy noise to even muscle, what land of Oz, what person behind the polar cap, what plastic surgeon eluded, what Ellis Island kite cliff, oh, Dago Jimmy Durante, what majestic mound of cartilage, what crooked center of face, the bump and kink of neck it takes to kiss you, the tilt and beautiful maneuvering. You know what they say about the size of a man's giant bridge for glasses, the grander than Roman, the grandeur, the Semitic spatial abrasion, so big cheeks double as bodybuilders, the tip too often graced by tongue. There is a toucan impersonation in your future, a Halloween trick and a Groucho Marx mask. What wondrous past this olfactory anomaly must manufacture? What gas, what pickled brine, what stench once cut through? What raw fish, what raw flesh, what offense so opulent to make such a monument?
So, yeah.
You're kidding me.
Let's see. Okay. Yeah, one more thing, and then I think we'll open it up. I brought a ton of stuff. And,
no, read more.
No, I think, I mean, I could read more Breach Shalom stuff, but I'm thinking I have a Passover thing. Well, maybe we'll read a few more of our pieces.
Read your stuff, yeah.
Yeah,
okay. I got more. Like,
so I'm not even going to attempt something resembling poetry, although I do write poetry, but I'm gonna read to you from a sermon. Now, don't worry, I'm not gonna read the whole sermon, but this is an excerpt from the sermon I gave on Rosh Hashanah about whistleblowing, and I think it's apropos of our subject of dissent, and I talk about at the beginning, which is the Jewish tradition of dissent, but also dissent in American culture, which I think as American Jews we can't really separate anymore. So I'll read this, and then we'll see what happens.
I got one more.
Okay, and I have something Passover themed too. Okay. So, all right. On Rosh Hashanah, yeah, because this is not seasonally appropriate. All right. On Rosh Hashanah, the day for asking the hard questions, it's well worth asking. Who has committed the greater crime? The government that breaks the law and covers its actions up under the pretense of national security, or the single individual that breaks the law in order that these crimes might be brought out into the light? It's well worth asking why. Why is Chelsea Manning facing 35 years in prison for revealing the disturbing truths about her government's actions in Iraq, while the very leaders who deceived us into that war have yet to be made to account for their actions? And why, for that matter, is Edward Snowden, the man who blew the whistle on the NSA's surveillance on American citizens, before have been forced to live in exile in Russia, while our Director of National Intelligence can deny the facts Snowden brought to light under oath and still remain in his job? I believe Jewish tradition demands that we ask these kinds of questions. After all, asking hard questions to powerful leaders is a time-honored Jewish value that dates all the way back to the days of the prophets. The prophets were, in fact, the whistleblowers of their day. Just like our present-day examples, they too spoke truth to power. They too sought to publicly reveal political corruption and hypocrisy of the governments of their time, and they too were hounded and persecuted by the powers that be for their truth-telling. I've said and written often that I believe the prophetic stream in Judaism to be the most important, and in many ways the most sacred, of our tradition. As a Jew, I've always been enormously proud of the classic rabbinical response to government power. I believe that the Jewish people have been able to survive even under such large and mighty powers because we've clung to a singular sacred vision that says there is a power even greater. Greater than Pharaoh, greater than Babylon, even greater than the mighty Roman Empire and the myriad of powerful empires. empires that have come and gone since. As Jews, we know all too well that powerful nations and empires have historically exploited fear in order to increase their control at home and abroad. To be sure, it's when times are fearful that we need these kinds of truth tellers the most. In today's post-9/11 world, I think it's fair to say that levels of our government's control and the secrecy it employs to cover it up go deeper than anything we witnessed, even at the height of the Cold War. During his first presidential campaign, Obama promised to rein in Washington's culture of secrecy that has grown so significantly since our nation's so-called war on terror. While we can argue about whether or not he's been successful in this regard, it cannot be denied that Obama has become the most aggressive president in American history when it comes to whistleblowers. Until this administration, only three government whistleblowers, including Daniel Ellsberg, has ever been charged by the Justice Department under the Espionage Act of 1917. Under Obama, the Justice Department has brought charges against 8 individuals, more than all previous American presidents combined. His administration's actions drive home the reality that this issue is not really about left or right. It is about government, and in particular, large, powerful governments such as ours that will invariably abuse their power and act to cover up their abuses. To quote another great American truth teller, the venerable investigative journalist Izzy Stone, "All governments lie." Stone didn't mean this to be a criticism of government itself. On the contrary, he wrote endlessly about the critical role governments must play in creating ordered and just societies. He simply meant that there will always be a gap between what a government does and what it says it is doing, and that as citizens, we cannot merely sit back and assume governments will voluntarily rein in their abuse of power or hold themselves to account. That, quite frankly, is our job, and that is why whistleblowers are so critical, and why I believe they are worthy of our gratitude and support. They represent, in a sense, the final defense of an informed citizenry. They are the ones who are willing, at great personal sacrifice, to hold the most powerful people and institutions in the world accountable. I know that all citizens want to trust their governments. We all want to believe our governments have our best interests at heart and will act to keep us safe, particularly in fearful times such as these. But as fearful as we are, we would do well to ask whether increased militarism abroad and the narrowing of our civil liberties here at home will truly bring us security in the end. As for me, I tend to agree with Daniel Ellsberg, who recently wrote, quote, "One of the lessons of the Pentagon Papers and Snowden's leaks is simple. Secrecy corrupts just as power corrupts." End quote. Today, as in years past, we owe a profound debt to those courageous enough to tear down the shrouds of secrecy, often at enormous personal cost, so that we may all find our way to a future of true security. Not a false sense of security in which the powerful hide behind higher and higher walls, but a real security based on leaders and citizens who are truly accountable to one another. After all, isn't that what our sacred day today is all about? When we sound the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we are, in a sense, blowing the whistle. The shofar represents, among other things, an act of revelation. When the shofar is sounded, we bring all the secrets of the past year out of the shadows. We announce our readiness to shine light into the dark places of our souls and all the actions for which we are accountable. We do this because we know deep down that secrecy corrupts the soul, and that true security, true liberation, can only come from living lives of transparency and openness. I do believe what is true for our national soul is true for our individual souls as well. Up until now, I've been specifically addressing the topic of government whistleblowers, but of course, whistleblowing takes many forms. It comes in many shapes and sizes. You might say that each of us is presented the opportunity to be a whistleblower in ways large and small each and every day. Every day, each of us is challenged by the Torah's words, "Do not follow the multitude to do wrong." Indeed, in the coming year, each of us will inevitably be faced with a challenge to speak out or remain silent, to remain in the darkness, in a place of secrecy and shame, or to shine a light into the dark places that we might all find our way forward together. This new year, I hope we can all find the means to be truth tellers in our own right, to find the courage to speak where there is only silence, and to wrestle honestly with the questions, what is the world in which we truly seek to live? Where, in the end, will we find true security? And what are we willing to do about it? Baruch ma'avir afeila u'mevi ora. Blessed is the one who removes the darkness and brings light. Amen.
We can open it up.
Yeah, I think we're going to open it up and then maybe do one more at the end. But first of all, your prose is it's beautiful, man. yeah, although, you know, I don't know what do you want to hear?
I want to hear opening the door for Elijah.
You know, I don't have that with me. I know. But you can get it online for the free. I think I have that. Yeah, you can listen to it online, and that's in the first book. Thank you. Sorry.
Is it in Shtick?
It's in my first book, Slingshots. Yeah. But you can listen to it online, and it's a holiday classic.
Read it at your Seder table.
Yeah, read it at your Seder table. Are we saying that Israel is indeed a colonialist model? And if so, what is the best way forward, essentially? Is that fair? All right. So for me, yes. And the best way forward is to have actual democracy, you know? I think for me, if it's in Chicago or if it's in Palestine, I believe in equity. And I don't think that you can make an excuse for having the scales of justice so tipped towards one community as opposed to another. And so for me, the answer remains in that space of what is fair and what is right and what is just.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add. I do believe, I resisted for a long time seeing Israel as a colonial state, and I do believe that it is. I think there are many Jews who look at Zionism as the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, and I've even used words like that myself in the past, and I've come to realize that that is a true perversion of what those terms are. Liberation movements are movements of peoples who are being occupied, who are struggling for their freedom. Zionism was a movement that colonized historic Palestine from Europe into Palestine. It has some differences from classic colonial powers, but at its core, however, I think it continues. It's that colonization process that continues at this very moment. So I do see it as a colonial settler state. I think there's no doubt in my mind about it. And the solution is, as Kevin said, I think we need to go from a colonial mindset, even from a national rights mindset, you know, this talk of national self-determination and national rights to individual rights and human rights, and looking at the solution as being one that whatever the final political parameters might look like, and I think with the collapse of the peace process currently, when you read Hans Kohn talking about the collapse of the peace process in 1929, and you see where we are today, there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that we are just over and over and over again using models that are just destructive to that place, and that the answer is in something that we take for granted as Americans: equal rights for all people who live on that land. Whatever the final political parameters need to be, whatever cultural and national autonomy needs to be factored in, everybody who lives there needs to have equal rights and civil rights and democracy. And I don't see how that's such a radical thing. It's a radical thing to suggest, perhaps, which only goes to show how utterly perverse the so-called conflict is. Well, I spend more time with Christians than with Jews these days, many of whom are in this room with me. I think for too long we've been hiding behind something that we call interfaith dialogue. And what that looks like is really two things. One is, look at all the wonderful things we have in common, and look how we're all just so much alike. And the other is sweeping the really difficult conversations under the rug. And I think true dialogue happens when you shine a light on the tough stuff. And so that's what we need to be doing. Really learning about where we butt up against one another and naming the elephants in the room. And in the Jewish Christian world and interfaith world, I would add Muslim in there as well, Israel-Palestine is one of the biggest elephants in the room. And for too long, interfaith dialogue has meant we don't talk about Israel-Palestine. Hmm. And there are many people in this room who are familiar with this process. Mark Ellis, one of the great Jewish dissidents alive today, calls the ecumenical deal, which is basically we can talk about anything but the price that the Christian community pays for its role and complicity in the Holocaust means towing the line when it comes to the American establishment's line, a political line on Israel-Palestine. And I think that deal needs to be attacked. I think we need to form new kinds of coalitions that are based not on glossing over difficult realities or truths, but based on justice and rights and universal values that we all share, no matter how uncomfortable it might make us. So I'm finding that in the Christian world, there are many who are eager for Jewish voices saying these things in the Protestant world, but also I'm learning a great deal about the Christian world every day. You know, I've met many evangelical Christians who are eager to have this conversation on a social justice space level. And I'm finding Jews, members of the Jewish community, who are also eager to reframe the conversation. Yeah, so Ben's question was, is there anything redeemable about Zionism, maybe taking into account the cultural Zionists like Reed Shalom, people like Ahad Ha'am, who I didn't read from, but who were not politically focused, but used Zionism as a way to promote the cultural national rebirth of the Jewish people. And Ben also mentioned that if we don't see Zionism as a national liberation movement, what about revisionist Zionists like the Irgun, who performed armed attacks, terrorist attacks against the British, for what they believed was driving, the colonialists out of their historic homeland, and they firmly believed that they were a liberation movement. If I was around in 1929, I probably would consider myself a Zionist the way Magnus and Conan and Arendt did as well. And but to talk about binationalism today means to be an anti-Zionist. I mean, that's just the sort of the historical reality. That kind of Zionism, I mean, Hans Kohn's letter was sort of the beginning of the death knell of that kind of Zionism. It was a small, very important movement that made a valiant fight. Hannah Arendt, in a piece I didn't read, wrote an article in Commentary Magazine, of all places, in 1948, after the partition plan, the violence was rising, saying there's still time to turn back from this madness. There's still time. It's not too late. It's just heartbreaking to read it. Those Zionists just don't exist anymore. So I identify with them today, but as a Jew living in 2014, that puts me in a non-Zionist camp. That's just sort of the historical reality of the way things have evolved.
Yeah, I think, KRS-One said, Senator Dole doesn't understand the young. They be saying 1-2 while we be saying 1. And for me, I think that to be a Zionist, to be a nationalist in this moment is not really the work of being a Jew, which is to do the work of Tikkun Olam, which is to repair the world and make it whole and holy again. And so right now, for me, we have to be careful about, I think, who we're aligning ourselves with politically. And if it's not, if it's Christians who want us there because, they see it as the fruition of the Book of Revelations, let's be careful. And if it's folks who don't want to have an honest conversation about, day-to-day, moment-to-moment human rights violations and the denial of history, then I think we need to reimagine. I'm not a historian, I'm a utopian, and I believe that the best part of our tradition is to move forward and to always go towards Zion. But Zion is not a state in a plot of land. Zion is when the Messiah will come, which means that we'll all celebrate the Sabbath and put down our weaponry. That's what that means.
That's Judaism, babe.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly some of the stuff that I read and some of the stuff that, Brant read, we had talked about wanting to get together a Freedom Seder, but got busy with things. So. But I think that, I think that's just a good task for everybody. To me, Judaism is also about the constant negotiation between history and the present and making the history relevant in this moment. And so to, always weave together inspirational sources that are liberation texts for our new Haggadah seems incredibly relevant and fresh. So do that. And yeah, I mean, all these folk, you know, like throw Amiri Baraka in there. Throw Aimé Césaire is a African poet from Martinique who talks about the desire to use the imagination, the utopian imagination, to dictate a world that is better and fresher than this one, you know. So there's, I don't know, there's a lot we could chat after. Aimé Césaire. I'm not really good at spelling, but
all right. Thank you.
What, some other suggestions? Yeah, one day Kevin and I will do our Liberation Seder.
Next year.
Next year in Chicago.
Evanston.
Too often, you write a Haggadah, people, their noses are buried in the Haggadah, you read it like a script, which I don't think is what the Seder was originally meant to be. It's meant to be a conversation. So I wouldn't worry too much about finding, cutting, pasting all these great texts and making a perfect Haggadah. I would rather use the Haggadah as a jumping off point to have a conversation. So using the different symbols of the Seder to ask questions and then open it up. The central part of the Seder is called Magid, which is the telling of the story. And there, I would use that as an opportunity to, you know, people like, voices like Kevin just mentioned, and others, they could be people in Chicago. They could be people who are on the South Side who are fighting against pet coke coming into their, you know, poisoning their communities. Hearing the voices from actual people struggling for liberation, whether it's in our own backyard or historically, hearing them, inviting them to the Seder to tell their stories and to open that conversation, or reading, you know, quotes from the actual people themselves throughout history, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Palestinian, whether they're Hispanic, including those, and then talking about what you've read or what you've heard, I think is really the key. We get so caught up in cutting and pacing the perfect Haggadah sometimes, and then we miss the boat in terms of what's really important about the experience.
Well, isn't that what the Seder is for, too? It's not just to say we were slaves back in the day, but that there is still an ongoing struggle for justice and equity. And if we don't continue to fight that fight, then we're not living up to, we shouldn't call ourselves Jews, I think, in a lot of ways, you know? So I think, like, to do this work of what Brandt said, like, all of the struggle in the moment at that table, like, it's open for discourse. You know?
To hear from the voices of the people themselves. So yeah. If you're going to have an olive on the Seder plate service, a Seder, have Palestinians there. Don't just talk about Palestinians. Have them there telling you their stories. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I think that, you know, there's historical precedence. I think that, you know, there's a government after apartheid falls, and you have issues, you have problems, but people figure it out. I think the will of the people who work and want common good things for their family and might want it for their neighbor, I think people will figure it out in time. I think that's the practice of democracy. So if we really believe in democracy, then we should practice it everywhere. I think inevitably you're going to have people scraping, and you know, you're going to have settlers who are really pissed that they got to bounce. But that's going to happen, you know. And we're going to have a lot of things that we need to deal with and need to figure out which borders and, you know, when I think that there should be a right of return. And so what does that look like when folks might have to, you know, get out of their homes that they've been in? But maybe they'll be, you know, I think maybe they'll build up. I don't know. Skyscrapers, I'm not sure.
There's plenty of room.
There's plenty of room.
Yeah. You know, I participated a few years ago at a One State Solution conference at the Kennedy School at Harvard. I was really honored to speak, and I went in with great trepidation and ended up hearing there's talk going on. I mean, right now, that kind of talk is being marginalized because the peace process has just solidified this two-state solution paradigm, a certain kind of two-state solution, which I don't think really talks about two actual states. I think it talks about one state and a Bantustan state. Mm-hmm. But it marginalizes the conversation. And one of the revelations for me at that conference was that there are people having creative conversations even now about what the political parameters might look like, whether it's a federated system, whether it's a binational system, whether it's a system of cultural and national autonomy in different areas. I mean,
And right now, those are the conversations I think we need to have on a hypothetical level. There are no movements right now, political movements, supporting these ideas. It's happening largely in the activist world and the academic world. But I think increasingly, when the reality of the latest death knell of this latest 8.0 peace process is clear, there's not going to be another one. I don't think it's possible that there's going to be another one. I think we're going to hear more, hear much more about these kinds of political parameters for what the state might look like. In the meantime, there is very real oppression that's going on as we speak in that place, and I see that as our first order of business, which is protesting against the oppression that's going on. And I think there are the precedents that Kevin talked about. Once political powers are forced into changing, then you can really start to have the creative conversations that are necessary.
Breed Shalom?
Yeah.
Breed Shalom doesn't exist anymore.
It
does not exist, no. He probably said exactly what he said before. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
Yeah.
His words are just, he could be speaking today. I think he'd be calling for, I don't know if he would call it a binational state, given the reality now. I mean, he died in 71. I'd be curious to know if he did any writing or thinking post-67 about the occupation. I think the core of the ideas is still the same. It's just that it's not being done in a Zionist context anymore. That's being treated as beyond the pale by the Jewish establishment community.
Hearing this, I think the reality of it is that was
the Irgun was very, very supportive of Great Britain before the White Paper. So they were in bed with the colonial. They were not above the Irgun and the revisionist Zionists were not above aligning with colonial imperial powers when it suited their purposes. They turned against the British. It was in 1939, I think, or 33 or 39, after the White Paper. So it was completely their own designs. They weren't fighting the British because they disagreed with the colonial imperial powers that the British represented. They were fighting them because they weren't supporting their aims. Briefly, I think we need to put this into a context. It doesn't stand alone. This is part of a larger movement for standing together with indigenous peoples all over the world and standing down colonial imperial designs all over the world. This is, Israel happens to be America's most important Fort Apache in that part of the world, but it's part of a larger picture, and we need to find common cause with the struggle all across the globe.
And I think that's some of the hope, is that in solidarity with other movements, with other groups, you'll find these practices of movement, of peace, of something towards justice, which is why the prospect of decolonization is not so scary, because there is precedent for it. Of course, it would be very helpful if in this country we admitted our transgressions against indigenous people and people that we brought here against their will. We stay on that, but that's part of the role of the maintenance of white supremacy at the systemic level, that we deny history. And so part of what I think we're saying is that we have to have an honest conversation about not only what has happened, but where we're at now and how we can move forward, most importantly. I think we're going to do one more piece each, and then maybe we could have informal conversations. Obviously, it's a big conversation, but we've also been here for an hour and a half. So, I'm going to read. We're each going to read one more piece, and then we could chit-chat. This book, Shtick, I kind of wrote for a lot of reasons. I wanted to celebrate things, particularly Jewish, my family, and noses and practices. There's an ode to gefilte fish in there. You can put that on the Seder table. Seriously. But at the end, there's also, the book, it ends with a conversation about Palestine. And this is a poem I wrote a few summers ago when I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Margaret Burroughs, who started the DuSable Museum for African American Art and History and the Southside Community Arts Center. She has a poem called "What Shall I Tell My Children Who Are Black?" And so I took the inspiration from that piece and wrote this poem, What Will I Tell My Jewish Kids? You can hear me in the back, right?
Yeah.
All right, awesome. What will I tell my Jewish kids who may not really know they are, whose parents eat BLTs in the country club and practice capitalism on the Sabbath, whose suburb began voting conservative in the generation after civil rights, whose great-grandfathers survived the Shoah, and whose grandfathers suffer Islamophobia? What will I say to my little nieces and nephews who celebrate Christmas, who hunt for Easter eggs, who like Mel Gibson movies, who adore the whitewash and Wonder Bread on Pesach? What will I tell my little homies who run out of gym class asking why their cocks are cut? What will I tell the girls when their noses grow, hair frizzes, hips widen when they don't look a damn thing like Barbie? What do I tell the bar mitzvah boys who end up studying man's law before God's? What will they understand of pigeonholes in a pigeon their tongue has no taste for? I will tell them we are middlemen, liminal women, go-between, seams in Babylon, olives holding the sky and earth together, synthesizers of the sacred and profane. We are bankers. Pagans and Christians thought it devil's work and we wanted to survive, so we are hustlers, pawnbrokers, slumlords, the white folk who used to live near black folk. Of course, we got into the music business. The melancholy melodies remind us of our own Hassan, our own sorrow in diaspora. We George Gershwin, we blackened up, we wronged our neighbors, but we connect a people on the always brink of civil war, so we are a bridge people, Red Sea parters, synthesizers between the warring. We see connections, the I, the I and thou. Buber taught us that, or was it Haile Selassie? I will certainly tell my Jewish kids of Goodman and Schwerner, who died with their brother James Earl Cheney, that for a time we were freedom riders. Along with others, we were central in the movement, hated Jim Crow ourselves. For a time in this country, we were the others. Now we are other than ourselves. I will tell my Jewish kids, we have a long story, more than what is seen now. We are a people who wander and wonder, who have a bag prepared in the corner in case. I will tell them, Israel is not a Jewish state. It is an empire state, a state against people and a state against God, a God who is certainly borderless and nationless, a God who is certainly without drone missiles and air raids. In a Jewish state, no tank stands between people seeking water or medicine. I will tell them, Israel is a farce, the guilt of the Western world, a Christian admission of the Holocaust, a watchdog over oil, a stepchild power mad, a baby country raging against everything I know to be Jewish. I will tell them, help dismantle this state. Zion is yet to be. The struggle is in becoming. This is the truth. It will exit us. It will exit us. This truth will set us free. And just one more thing, because I also grew up on Maxwell Street, I got the book in the back for 10, but I got a lot of books with me, and so you could get 3 books for 20. I'm just saying, holler at your boy. All right, thank you.
He's also selling tube socks.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I got it all. That's why I brought my bag.
I love that poem. I love it every time I hear it said. That's a hard act to follow.
No.
All right. Well, I'm. I think I was going to read something seasonal, but I think I'll read something else. This was a. I was recently asked by Al Jazeera to debate another rabbi about Zionism. So I'm going to read to you from this article. It came out relatively recently. It's called A Jewish Dream Beyond Political Nationalism. Rabbi Brad Rosen explains why he's not a Zionist. And this was a debate with Rabbi Ari Hart, who's actually from Chicago, lives in New York, a very talented and wonderful
contemporary Orthodox rabbi who's very involved in the social justice community, one of the founders of Greenland Tzedek, which is an Orthodox social justice organization that does important work. And he wrote, Why I Am a Zionist, and this is my response to him. So you're going to have to imagine that I'm responding to certain things that you haven't heard already, but you can get the idea, I think. Like Rabbi Hart, I am profoundly inspired by the Jewish dream of return so powerfully evoked in Psalm 126. I do not, however, understand these words to be a blueprint for Jewish political nationalism. For most of Jewish history, in fact, the Jewish dream of return to the land was not understood literally, but was rather projected into a far-off messianic future. The rabbinic sages who developed Jewish tradition forcefully prohibited the forcing of God's hand through the establishment of an independent Jewish state. The rabbis were well aware that their last experience with Jewish statehood, the Hasmonean kingdom that emerged out of the Maccabean revolt in 110 BCE, collapsed in less than 100 years and ended in disaster for the Jewish people. It is notable that the prophetic reading chosen for Hanukkah, the festival that commemorates the Maccabean victory, contains the famous verse, "Not by might and not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." Judaism, as we know it, emerged as a religious response to ill-fated nationalism and empire, building a global peoplehood transcending mere land, borders, and militarism. While nation-states may come and go, the rabbis taught, the Jewish people have survived. Why? Because we put our faith in a power even greater than the mightiest empire, the God of justice and righteousness. In its origins, political Zionism was inspired less by Jewish tradition than by modern European nationalism. While many today easily conflate Judaism with Zionism, it is important to note that the Zionist movement was but one of many Jewish movements that proliferated with the onset of modernity. For its part, political Zionism sought to negate the diaspora in favor of a nationalist, land-based expression of Jewish peoplehood, an ethos clearly evoked by Rabbi Hart when he writes about the Jewish people's right to self-determination and self-defense like any other people. However, words such as these are less a reflection of Judaism, per se, than the parlance of 19th century nationalism. Moreover, there is a decided difference between a people seeking to assert their right to self-determination from under their thumb of colonial domination and a colonial settler ideology such as Zionism, which actively sought to create a state by colonizing a land already inhabited by an indigenous people. Indeed, even within the Zionist movement itself, there was a powerful debate over the establishment of a political Jewish nation state in historic Palestine. Up until the very founding of the State of Israel, prominent Jewish figures such as Rabbi Judah Magnus, Hannah Arendt, Martin Buber, and Albert Einstein, didn't mention him, were vociferous opponents of the creation of an ethnically Jewish state in a land as religiously and culturally diverse as Palestine. The establishment of such a state, they warned, would result in tragedy for Jews and Arabs alike, resulting in a garrison state doomed to perpetual war. Today, 65 years after the establishment of the Jewish state, these warnings resonate with painful prescience. Although it was originally founded to be a haven for world Jewry, today Israel is the only Jewish community in the world that lives in a constant state of existential threat and is literally building higher and higher walls between itself and the outside world. Israel has now become the most militarized nation in the world, devoting the highest percentage of its national GNP to military spending. It is also one of the world's leading arms exporters, largely successfully marketing its weapons as battle-tested on live subjects in the occupied territories. Israel also shares its military expertise with numerous abusive, undemocratic regimes across the globe. In the wake of Nelson Mandela's death, it is worth noting that Israel maintained a close military alliance with the South African apartheid regime for many decades. Perhaps most ominously, Israel has introduced nuclear weapons into the Middle East. While Jewish statehood has certainly spawned impressive achievements, it is myopic in the extreme to tout Israel's scientific and economic and academic advances without mentioning the extent to which these resources are directed toward the proliferation of militarism at home and throughout the world. While Rabbi Hart is certainly correct when he asserts the ways the state of Israel has benefited Jewish people, I am struck by the fact that he is relatively silent on the precise nature of the nightmare it has created for the indigenous people of the land. I believe that as Jews, we must be willing to own this dark history and say it out loud. During 1947, 1948, Zionist military forces either displaced or forcibly expelled over 700,000 Palestinians and then forbid their return, creating what is today the largest refugee population in the world. Today, more than 4 million Palestinians harbor their own dream of return, not to a mythic biblical homeland, but to a land that they remember only too well. In short, Israel's founding is inextricably bound up with an inherent injustice to the people who had made a home in this land. More critically, it is an injustice that continues until today through policies of dispossession and displacement designed to maintain a Jewish demographic majority in the state of Israel. Like Rabbi Hart, I fervently dream of a land which will be, in Isaiah's words, a house of prayer for all peoples. But what will make it so? The policies I have spelled out above have thwarted a true two-state solution that would allow, as he puts it, Palestinian self-determination in Palestine. While the final political parameters of this conflict have yet to be spelled out, it simply must be a solution that makes for full rights for all who dwell in the land. Until that day, we cannot let our euphoria at the existence of a Jewish state blind us to the very real human rights abuse Israel regularly commits in our name. In the meantime, here is my dream. It is rooted in the Torah's teaching that all human beings are made in God's image and are eminently worthy of dignity and respect. It is rooted in the central story of my tradition, the Exodus, in which God stands with the oppressed and demands that we do the same. And it is rooted in the Torah's injunction that the land does not belong to us but to God, and that one law must be extended for all who dwell upon it.